Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming along. It's a rotten day to be travelling outside, and I think we probably have a cohort of people caught somewhere between somewhere else and here, caught in the rain. So, but I'm glad that you could make it all. It's an incredibly important subject, and it's one that we're going to be focusing on this year in our presentations, in our program. One of the subjects we're going to be focusing on is the state of the international economy, and it's hard not to focus on the state of the international economy when you wake up in the morning and hear every morning at about 3 minutes to seven the ABC telling us what the Greeks are up to again. And at the risk of boring at least half of you rigid, I was, towards the end of last year, passed on an explanation for the problems in the Greek and the European pigs' economies. And it goes something like this. A couple of years ago, a Greek Lord Mayor went to pay a visit to one of his counterparts in Spain on a get-to-know-you visit, as they're everybody is entitled to do in the European Union, so that you get to know each other and there'll be no problems within the family. And the Spaniard had a very, very nice house up on top of a hill overlooking a valley, new, beautifully constructed. And the Greek said to him, "My goodness, this is a beautiful house." And he said, "Well, thank you very much." And he said, "What do you do?" And he said, "Oh, I'm the mayor." He said, "Yes, I know you're the mayor. And what do you do?" He said, "Oh, well, I've got a small plot of land over there." Ding, ding. And he said, "Well, but this house is so beautiful." And he said, "Yes, yes." He said, "Well, look, I'll tell you the secret." He said, "See that gorge over there?" And the other mayor looked across at the gorge. And he said, "You see that single-lane bridge coming across the gorge?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, the EU gave us the money to build a two-lane bridge so that you could have cars going across at the same time. So at this stage there were traffic lights at the end of the one lane." And he said, "Oh, and what happened to the rest?" And he said, "Well, we were able to use some of the money to build this house." And so the Greek thought, "That was pretty good." And about a year or so later, the Spanish mayor made a reciprocal visit to Greece, and he arrived at this mini Parthenon, and pillars everywhere, most ornate, most beautiful house. And he said to the Spaniard, said to the Greek mayor, he said, "My goodness, what a wonderful house you've got." And he said, "Yes, yes, we're very proud of it, and we were able to build it pretty quickly, and it's really nice." And he said, "Okay, tell me how you did it." And the Greek mayor said, "Now you see that gorge over there?" And he said, he said, "Yes." He said, "You see the bridge across the gorge?" And Spenny said, "No. Where?" Anyway, that's just a little bit of laughter. It's an old catastrophe or potential catastrophe in Europe. Of course, it's not a laughing matter, but it is a very serious issue. And we're very lucky to have this evening Professor Ian Harper, who's a very well-known economist in Australia. He's been... he was, going back in time, a member of the Wallace Inquiry, which was responsible for much of the financial reform that took place in Australia and has probably arguably put us on, at least largely, on the path in which we now are in terms of our capacity to handle international ups and downs. After a 25-year academic career, he became a partner at what is now Deloitte Access Economics. He was the inaugural chairman of the Australian Fair Pay Commission and is a panellist on the Victorian Independent Review of State Finances. Some people get the good jobs. Good luck with that latter one. And we look forward very much to what you have to tell us about what we're going to hear on the radio tomorrow and the day after and the day after. So thank you very much.
As the President's just indicated, I've been asked to talk to you about the situation in Europe and the international economy more broadly. I'm delighted that the Institute is interested in the international economy, because it's clearly one of the most important things that's going to be driving our economic future as we look out over the next 12 months at the very least. While we do chuckle about the sorts of stories, and that's a terrific story, I know that one myself, it's always a good story to tell, and it is about other people's money in the end, and it is about people being very careless about managing income and expenditure. These things in the end have as the basis some violation of the Micawber principle, people spending more than they earn. But we shouldn't laugh too loudly. Even though our circumstances federally in this country are pretty good, I have to tell you that as a result of the inquiry that the President just referred to, which I hope the government will make public very soon, here in Victoria, while we're the best of all of the states, it is basically true for us too. Income for the states has reduced its rate of growth as a result of international economic circumstances, and expenditure has not. And in essence, that is the same problem which the Europeans face. Now, of course, before we run out screaming, our circumstances are of a different magnitude, and our institutions are different. But the essential problem of expenditure now riding much higher than income, and the implications of that down the pike, are clear. One little conclusion I think I can share with you without, I hope, offending the government, is that our calculations indicate that if no change were made, and I'm clearly not presuming that the government will make no change, my great hope is that they will. They've already made some preliminary announcements, as you would know. But if no change were made, here in Victoria, we would be borrowing to finance recurrent public expenditure. I don't need to explain to anybody who's managed their own finances what that means. Clearly, we need to do something about changing the rate of growth of expenditure and various other aspects of government activity in this state, and when our report is made public, you'll see a whole raft of recommendations there for the government to deal with. They are of a piece with the sorts of things that the Germans are demanding the Greeks do. Given our circumstances are nothing like that in magnitude, although the direction is still the same, one would hope that the reaction in Victoria to the government attempting to address this would be nothing like the reaction in Greece. One hopes. But the underlying problem is the same. So, just as by way of preface for my remarks tonight, while we'll be focusing on the misfortunes of many of those outside the country, and when we get to the end of my remarks very briefly saying, well, of course, here in Australia, things are pretty good, I, for one, don't want you to hear me being complacent, and I don't think that any of us should be complacent, because essentially you're there but by the grace of God, or frankly there but for a few years down the pike, would go ourselves. I've been asked to talk to you then about the economy internationally, and I've prepared this presentation, which I hope or intend to take just a half an hour or so of your time to present, and then I'd be very pleased if we would have a conversation in the room. I'm delighted to be able to answer to the best of my ability any questions that you might care to ask, and if I can't answer them, I'll tell you. Okay. The world economy obviously is slowing, we know that. It won't go into recession at a global level. The forecasts are that Europe probably will go into a mild recession, unless the wheels really fall off, or as my colleague Chris Richardson says, unless we see Eurogeddon, as he describes it. I don't know the last time that he actually read the Book of Revelation, but I have a go at him about that, treating such things lightly. Nevertheless, if the wheels really do fall off, then indeed, there is no doubt that a severe recession in Europe could carry the world into recession. There's no doubt about that. There are more people, of course, in Europe than there are in the United States, and the European economy collectively, beyond the Eurozone, is a very large economy, and as a result of that, if it were to go into recession, the world economy would. We're forecasting that there would be a mild recession nevertheless this year, but for the rest of the world, that there would be modest growth in the other advanced economies. Listening to those radio reports the President mentioned, you would have heard that the news out of the United States has been better than it has been for a little while. One should never write the United States off.
It is a remarkable place. And the US economy remains one of the most flexible economies on the planet, which says a lot about the United States people and their institutions, and none of which is to diminish the sorts of problems they've got, I might add, but they are remarkably inventive. Anyway, for the time being, the US economy appears to be picking itself up somewhat by its own bootstraps. The Japanese continue to just putter along, but at least there isn't any sign of the Japanese economy going into recession, but there are no signs of the Japanese economy becoming wildly active either. You might wonder why that makes any difference. Well, the Japanese economy is now the third largest. It's no longer the second largest, but it is still the third largest economy on the planet. And even though it doesn't grow very quickly, it's still very big. And that means that the activity of the Japanese economy is still important for the rest of the world. The emerging economies, of course, particularly in Asia, obviously China continue to lead the way. So the picture that we have is this. These are data that have been drawn from the most recent IMF survey, as you can see there. And if I just point you through the colours on the chart, obviously, to the right-hand side of the chart, we have the forecasts for this calendar year 2012 and for the so-called out year 2013. Before anybody reminds me, indeed, these are IMF forecasts, and yes, the IMF failed to predict the GFC. In fact, that the IMF has been really quite pessimistic about the way things are going to turn out, which aren't actually borne out in the data, their own forecasts. If I were to show you, for example, 2009, which I haven't done on this chart, obviously, over here, then this blue bar would have been below the axis, that is to say, it was showing negative growth. The advanced economies experienced negative growth during the GFC. For all the negative talk, even the IMF, that is of now, of course, very wary about what it says. And when people say that the IMF is, well, one needs perhaps to take with a grain of salt what the IMF and World Bank are saying, because they got bitten last time and they're rather embarrassed, and therefore they're going to make absolutely certain that they don't make that mistake again, and therefore one should roll back a little bit some of the rhetoric. I think that's valid. Part of the reason I think that is that the IMF's own forecasts don't match the darkness of their rhetoric. So what you can see here is the advanced economies, as we were saying, expected to slow, but still to grow. And the IMF is even expecting that the advanced economies would recover in 2013. What about ourselves? Here you can see for Australia is the light green coloured bar here. We, of course, didn't have any negative growth during the GFC, as you're aware. We came out of the GFC quite strongly. We've been a little slow lately, as you know. In 2012, we're expected to grow a bit faster. Those numbers are also backed up by the Reserve Bank. That is one of the reasons why the Reserve Bank didn't lower interest rates last time. Most of my colleagues are expecting that this calendar year here for us in Australia will be in two halves. The first half will look a little dark, and then the economy will recover quite strongly in the second half. Mostly driven by business investment, which has been absolutely enormous, coming on stream in a serious way. So a lot of money has been committed, but many of these projects have not actually gotten off the ground, and as they do in greater profusion, we'll start to see the output growth associated with that investment coming online. At least that's the prediction. And you can see here in the chart, at least, that the IMF also thinks that our growth will be roughly 3.5% on average over the next 2 years, and that's more or less what our forecasts show. 3 to 3.5% growth is trend growth for the Australian economy. So why are the banks laying people off in such profusion? Why is the car industry in trouble? Let's park that. They're good questions. Obviously, these are aggregate figures, and beneath the aggregate figures, much is happening at a sectoral level. And one of the big parts of our story, as you know, as the Treasurer keeps reminding us, quite correctly, is that we're experiencing the so-called multi-speed phenomenon. The Australian economy is going through dramatic structural change. because we are experiencing a mining boom which is larger. Well, put it this way, we have never seen anything like it since the 1850s, so larger relative to the size of the economy. In absolute terms, of course, we've never seen anything like it. But relative to the size of the economy, we've seen nothing like it since the 1850s. And that is driving not just economic activity, but the structure and shape of the Australian economy, and there are lots of dimensions to that. Again, let me come back to it, because it's a very important theme for Australia's economic development over the next 10, 20, arguably 30 years. There, of course, is the world economy, the blue bar, which is just an average, and we've not yet mentioned the grey bars. There they are, the emerging and developing economies. Yep, sure, they're going to grow a little more slowly. You think, well, why would you have any problems if you were growing at those rates? Nevertheless, the Chinese worry about growth rates that fall below 6% for them. When growth in China comes below 6%, they start to see unemployment rise in China. And the Chinese, I'm sure this audience would know better than me, given your interest in international affairs, the Chinese worry greatly about their ability to contain the mirror image of the structural change which is occurring in our economy in their economy. At this stage, roughly 300 million of the 1.3 billion Chinese have shared in the benefits of China's growth in a sort of palpable way. That leaves a billion. A large proportion of the billion Chinese, again, if you've travelled in that country, anywhere to the west of the coastal regions of China, you will know that many of those folk are living as if they were living in the Middle Ages. Except for one thing. They have access to modern communications. And they know what their cousins are experiencing on the coast. And the Chinese are no different from anybody else. They resent having those differences rubbed into their noses. That's an issue for the Chinese. They don't hide that. They always remind us of that. When people get concerned about the Chinese being aggressive externally, lots of time, the Chinese will say, pardon me, right? We're worried about the issues at home. Well, maybe, of course, they could help that by having some external aggression. I don't know. I'm not a political scientist, but what I do know is the Chinese worry about rates of growth that come down below 6%. These are averaged, of course, across the Chinese economy, the Indians, the Brazilians, and others. From the perspective of the world economy, there is the engine of growth. So the reason that our blue lines, pale blue, are going nowhere near world recession, well, growth recession may be. Some people think the world economy, if it grows less than 3%, is in growth recession. Doesn't even look like it's going to be there, but these are averages, of course, and they're predictions. There is no sign of absolute recession, i.e. negative growth. So is this a second GFC? Measured this way, clearly not. Could it become a second GFC? Well, if Europe falls apart in a major way. Hence the focus on Europe. Perhaps if we begin by taking a little look here at gross general government debt. I began my remarks by saying that the essence of this problem is the Micawber principle, people spending more than they earn, and over lengthy periods of time, and institutions which don't respond to the need to address that mismatch. Just to give you some idea of the scale of things, you can see across the top of the chart, in the light blue is Greece, and in red is Italy. And there's their gross debt as a proportion of GDP. You can see it rising in 1980 right up here to where we are now. And you can see the United States debt growing, nudging in this chart 100% of US GDP, which is concentrated the minds of US politicians. They have to get special permission to go above that. And they've not been there since the Second World War. So the US is not out of the woods, that's quite clear. The grey line is Portugal. This purpley line here is Spain. There are the Germans coming up on the outside in green. And down here is Australia. Oh. Beetle bomb at the back of the pack. So when the Prime Minister and the Treasurer tell you that, you know, relatively speaking, Australia has no problem, this, of course, is gross debt. With due respect to Senator Joyce, yes, these are gross debt figures. So, of course, if we wanted to take net debt, that is to say, to set off against this gross debt, the assets that the government has, then the levels of net debt for Australia are risibly low. The problem, however, Senator Joyce, is that one has to service gross debt, not net debt. And every mortgage holder knows exactly that. You're solvent. That isn't the problem. The bank will not sell you up because you're solvent. The bank will sell you up because you can't service the debt. That's the issue. And the same is true of the international capital markets. As difficult as it is to actually calculate the solvency of a country. Here's the next chart, which shows you some forecasts for the same selection of countries. There are the Greeks headed off into the wild blue yonder, literally in the case of this chart. And this is what it is, of course, that would lead people to be concerned about the Greeks defaulting on their debt. That assumes that they don't default, but are allowed to continue to borrow. There you can see them pulling away from the Italians, who are marked in red. And here are the Americans coming up in orange, and the Portuguese in grey. The Germans again in light green, stabilising. The Spanish here in purple. And once again ourselves down the bottom there. No obvious change for the Australian forecast, which is again what the government is telling us, and the government is completely correct about that. Here's a brief historical chart for those who are interested in these things. I mentioned that the United States, this chart actually finishes at 2007, so it doesn't pick up the increase in debt, particularly in the United States, as a result of the global financial crisis. If you look back, you will see the US figures. There they are there, beginning to pick up, as you can see, post the global financial crisis. The collapse of Lehman Brothers was in September of 2008. Then you see the US government picking up its debt as it rescues the private banking system in the United States. And what's happening now is the result of that, compounded together with various efforts to reform the US health system, fighting wars outside the United States, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, that still doesn't take them anywhere near where they were during or at the end of the Second World War, when debt to GDP had reached 150% in the United States. And other parts of the world, these previous charts don't have the British on there, but you can see that the world is no stranger to levels of debt to GDP which are astronomically high. The British obviously came out of the Second World War, really having fought two world wars in the early part of the century, 20th century, extremely indebted. And if you take those numbers and go back to the Napoleonic Wars, you'll find that William Pitt the Younger was indebted to an even greater extent. So how can this be that countries like, here are the Japanese, for instance, there are the Japanese sitting up there. This is prior to the onset of the global financial crisis, and the Japanese have already borrowed more than 150%, nearly 200% of Japanese GDP. Why isn't the bond market running a rout against the Japanese? Or the Americans, for that matter. Or the British. Why pick on the poor Greeks, Italians and Portuguese when their economies are tiny? And in gross terms, even though it's a high proportion of GDP, in gross terms the amount of money we're talking about is a fraction of what is owed by the US government or the Japanese government. The answer, of course, simply comes down to the confidence of the markets. And are the markets rational? Well, most of the time. At least the question that markets ask themselves is this: how likely do you think it is that that country and that government, with its institutions and policies and history, how likely do you suppose it is that they would meet their obligations as and when they fall due? The market draws the conclusion, notwithstanding what's happening in the United States, that there is plenty of capacity, so much so, as you well know, that the United States continues to be the preferred destination for investment. And if anything, the US dollar has been buoyed by funds coming in to the United States, notwithstanding all that we hear about the travail of debt and public finances in the United States. In the end, people look at the institutions and the policies and the history And they say, if I was a wagering person, which of course I am putting my money on their bonds, if I were a wagering person, then I would wager in favour of the United States. And frankly, Britain and Japan. But I have my doubts about the southern European countries. So it is about confidence and it's about institutions, which is why institutional economics is so important and why it's very important that we continue to manage institutions in our country to ensure that that confidence never departs. It's when the confidence departs that the trouble starts. And that wasn't an intended rhyme. Here we go. Let's talk a little more now about the Eurozone. Well, the Eurozone woes, of course, threaten to spill over, as we've been reading, and it is very difficult to see any resolution to the European debt crisis. If I could summarise the problem, and I hope not simplistically, it sort of runs like this. In every other example of a country, or generally is one country, that is simultaneously an economic union and a currency union, it is also a political union. And that combination, that threesome, that rope of three strands, that stool of three legs is stable. We know that. Because, of course, that's what we've got. Prior to federation, those of you who know your Australian history will know that the states raise tariffs against one another. We in Victoria hang our heads in shame. Raised tariffs against New South Wales. Each of the state banks was at the point of issuing its own currency. That's why they were there. And of course there was no political union, obviously. They were all independent colonies. So when the fathers, and they were fathers, of the Australian Federation sat down, they knew they had to tick at least three boxes. The first is that the Commonwealth would be an economic union. So there would be no restraint on interstate trade, Section 96. It would be a currency union, so the currency power was given to the Commonwealth. And the states would forswear issuing their own currencies and conducting what the Constitution quaintly calls banking policy. That's a matter for the Commonwealth. And of course the third obvious point at the time of federation is that the states would cede powers to the Commonwealth government and we would become a political union. Canada is the same. Germany is the same. The United States is the same. Different paths, but the same three things together. Economic union, currency union, and political union. Now let's come to our friends in the Eurozone. You see, they have two out of three. Economic union came first, then currency union. Now, to be fair, the idea was that if you had two out of three, then the third one might come. Lady Thatcher was a sceptic on that front. The third one might come. The sceptic said, yes, well, this is a bit like Sisyphus, I should say. You can roll this rock up the hill. And there is a chance indeed that the rock might roll over the other side under its own momentum. That's the optimistic view. If you have economic union and currency union, then political union will come. The pessimistic view is what Sisyphus found out to his cost. And that is that the rock comes down the hill just as fast, indeed faster than it goes up. And the whole thing can be lying in front of you in a complete mess. You never get political union, and without political union, you lose currency union and economic union. That, regrettably, is where these folk are. Why does it fall to pieces? Because there is no mechanism, if you have a currency union, there is no mechanism for sharing out the different fiscal burdens which arise because of different needs amongst the states and different economic circumstances. To make it absolutely clear, the value of the Australian dollar is too high for the Tasmanian economy. Unemployment is high in Tasmania anyway. It would be dramatically higher if we didn't pay the Tasmanians, essentially, to remain part of the Commonwealth and use the Australian dollar. The New Zealanders, of course, spurn our offer. even though they're a founding state. And they had their own currency, just as well, for them. But it's not true of South Australia and Tasmania. So we can make those fiscal transfers, and we do, much to the annoyance, of course, we've gotten used to it, in Victoria and New South Wales. But the most recent chums into this game are our friends in Western Australia, and they don't like it one bit. That they now have to write checks rather than receive them. And on the East Coast we say, well, welcome to the club, right? And soon you'll be writing checks to us, not just to the Tasmanians and the South Australians. They like that even less. And pretend that they're going to secede and join China or something. We love the West Coast. God bless them. Anyway, unless you can do that under the aegis of fiscal union, political union, then the whole thing ultimately falls to pieces. And that's what we are observing. Now, yes, can be wise after the fact. What was I predicting at the time? Well, I guess I might have been a skeptic, but my opinion didn't really matter. To be fair to those who believed in the European experiment, that was the logic. That if we had 2 out of 3, we could make the third work. And they tried with the Maastricht Treaty. More observed in the breach than the observance. And even now they talk about fiscal union, you'll note, which is another shade shy of political union. But maybe if we had some agreement. The Germans are saying, we need to come down and inspect what you do, they say to the Greeks. And the Greeks say, oh yeah, we know about that. That's a second occupation. How likely is it that fiscal union even would be achieved? When the Germans are making precise to the right point, no, we don't need to come down there anymore. We can just observe you from afar, and if you misbehave, we'll cut off your money. So the difficulty, ladies and gentlemen, is that at its foundation, this process is flawed. Unless you believe that they can make some form of political or fiscal union work. And those who are, as I say, optimists on the European front will hold that view, and others who believe we've never seen 2 out of 3 work before will hold a pessimistic view. And you can judge for yourself where you think that might come out. Well, economically, what are the three possibilities that could arise here? One obviously is that we do nothing on the exchange rate front. We stick with the euro, which is overvalued for the southern European economies. And what happens is that there will be a lengthy deep recession. These economies have to adjust somehow, and they will adjust through wages and prices. The economies have increasing unemployment. The Spanish youth unemployment is already 50%. Unemployment of adults is rising to 30%. This is the 1930s all over again, and the same argument is being run. How long do we have to wait before prices and wages in Greece and Italy and Spain are forced downwards to do the same job that a depreciation of the Greek drachma or the Spanish peso would have done like that? How long do we have to wait? The economists say, in the long run, all this will work out. And of course, J.M. Keynes famously retorted, in the long run, we're all dead. Well, long before we get to the long run, there could be political strife that's already started. The other is that we try to steer the markets down, and we say, no, 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 you markets have got it all wrong. This is going to work. And we will back this with money. We've got more money than you've got, so we're putting our money on the table. Let's have a look at what you've got to do. There's only one country in the end who can play that game, and that's the Germans. Will the Germans play that game? Well, they might, but they would only do so by extracting a price, and you can see them extracting that price right now, holding the Greeks right to the fire. The Greeks trying to play chicken with the Germans saying, we know that game, this knife is very sharp, you want to be a chicken? A partial breakup of the EU is the idea that, in fact, the Germans would leave, or one or two of the stronger economies would, or they just kick out the weaker economies. That is a breakup of the EU. Well, that seems like an easy thing to do. Why wouldn't we want to do that? Here's a chart that shows you how well the Germans are doing out of the Eurozone. The Germans complain about having to pay for it. They complain about the dissolution of other members of the European Union. But what doesn't often get said is how well the Europeans are doing out of this. Pardon me, the Germans. Right? The reality, folks, is this, that while it's true that the euro is way overvalued for the Greeks and the Italians and the Spanish and the Portuguese, it is undervalued for the Germans. And German manufacturing has grown like topsy. The Germans have increased their current account surplus way up here like this as they export more and more and import less and less. Meanwhile, down here, the poor old Greeks and the Spanish are having their manufacturing sectors, such as they exist in Greece, clobbered into ignominy by an exchange rate which is overvalued and by manufacturers which have essentially decamped to Germany. Classic structural mismatch. The problem for the partial EU solution is not that the Greeks or the Italians might necessarily object. It's that the Germans don't want that to happen. Well, you're going to have to pay for it, Ms. Merkel. And they're negotiating over the price. How much will the Germans pay to ensure that this system, which suits them, continues? Here's a chart of unemployment. There's the Spanish unemployment rate. That's bad. Here's the German unemployment rate. It's the only one on the chart going down. So one of the unkept secrets here is that the Germans are doing quite nicely out of this. Now that doesn't, I don't mean to imply that they're in some way boasting about this. I'm simply making the point to you that the Germans have a very strong financial interest in this process working and would lose a lot of money and a lot of economic growth if it fell apart. And the Italians and the Greeks know that. And that's why the negotiation with the Germans is so fraught. Well, they have Hobson's choice, you see. If they were to break the Eurozone up, then there are many banks, and not just banks within the Eurozone. The British banks are in this situation too. Many of them. Which is why the British bank regulator has insisted that all of the British banks rapidly increase their bank capitalization. Because if there is a breakup, then any institutions which find themselves with assets in the currency which is now depreciating and liabilities in the currency which remains strong, i.e., obviously Greek banks, which will have lent essentially in drachma and borrowed in euro, will become instantaneously bankrupt. And the same would be true of British banks that have lent to countries in Europe that are outside the Eurozone. They will now have liabilities denominated in British pounds and assets denominated in depreciating currencies. Unless they have sufficient capital bases, they're technically bankrupt. So the banks have to be recapitalized if this were to occur. Well, let's go the other way. What's the other way? Well, we may well end up with defaults on bonds unless we do something about fiscal policy. And the defaults on bonds will also cause banks to become bankrupt. Those banks that are holding those bonds will find their assets suddenly worthless, or worth 10 cents on the dollar, or 10p on the euro, whatever. So bank recapitalization will be required whatever happens. Well, who's got the money for that? Hence all the discussion about the European Financial Stability Fund, which is a pot of money the governments have sort of set aside. It's nowhere near large enough. Could the European Financial Stability Fund be leveraged with private borrowing in order to provide enough money to the governments to recapitalise the banks? Well, yes, if the European Financial Stability Fund could borrow from all of the Eurozone governments and be underwritten by all of them, then the answer is yes, we think. So the whole debate there is about how and on what terms we can stabilise the financial system. You want to know why people are selling the euro and rushing away and why there is instability in the bond markets is because of this. Whichever way you cut this particular pie, you end up with banks that are uncapitalised or undercapitalised. And that produces significant financial instability, which of course breaks on our shores. Well, folks, the ultimate solution here has to be some combination of fiscal austerity, i.e. solving the Micawber problem, default or recapitalization or restructuring of the debt in some form, and of course the old favourite, inflation. Of those, you know, the Germans won't tolerate inflation, at least not yet. And so they're left with default and fiscal austerity. They're pushing on the fiscal austerity button. But even that will require them to have to recapitalize banks, including some of their own, and they have to find a way through that. Is this a mare's nest? Yes. Does everybody look at it and go away and tear their hair? Yes. And if it falls apart, does it have the potential to throw the world economy into disarray? Yes. Are there ways through? Yes, but they require substantial discipline in deciding which of these combinations is actually going to work. There is one thing that the European Central Bank has not yet tried, and that is so-called quantitative easing. The US Fed has done that. It's controversial, but it may be why the US economy is now beginning to show signs of life. The one lever that has not yet been pulled is that the European Central Bank would begin essentially to print money. Now, while the Germans have the influence they have over the European Central Bank, it is almost a case of over our dead body. But as the riots in Europe begin to heat up, then the ECB may find itself under enormous pressure. Here's a little interesting chart that I discovered for you. This is much more up your alley than mine. Some enterprising economists have produced a little chart which goes back, well, over the period 1919 to 2008. And it correlates these different types of instability, that sort of generalized chaos. Demonstrations, riots, assassinations, and general strikes. And these enterprising economists have associated these events with gradual reductions in government expenditure, i.e. fiscal austerity. Now, just to show that it's normalized properly, the left-hand bar shows you what level of chaos, demonstrations, riots, assassinations you would expect even if the government were to increase its expenditure. In other words, Europe is no stranger to chaos, riots, assassinations, and the rest. But what is clear from the chart is that over that lengthy period of time, an increase in the incidence of these events of civil and social unrest is clearly associated with austerity. So the news is not good on that front, long before we really find the metal to engage an economic solution here, we'll be having to deal with traditional political strife in Europe. Everybody knows that. It's already started. How do we hold the economic game together long enough to find a solution before this bites us all firmly from behind? I can't answer that question, but the evidence is not good. A brief word on China. Well, of course, part of the reason that we are spared, or the main reason we are spared most of the fallout of this, is China. People say, well, but surely China would get sucked into the vortex if Europe goes down. Well, their export growth has already slowed because of what's happening in Europe. But the reality is that China has an enormous internal issue, internal growth. The Chinese are what? I don't know, you tell me. A quarter of the way, maybe a third, but no more than that. Up the economic development curve that it took the West 100 years to climb up. The Chinese will climb up much faster. They're climbing up on a scale which is unprecedented in human history, and behind them come the Indians, another 1 billion people. So the impact of the development, the growth and development that's occurring in China and India could last for another 30 to 40 years, you tell me. And throughout that process, they will be demanding goods originally, commodities, and ultimately services from us. It's a nice problem to have, but it is a problem. Hence the multi-speed economy for us. So the Chinese expecting to grow strongly. Inflation has eased in China, and so the Chinese have expanded money supply growth again. The Chinese are already stimulating the Chinese economy in expectation of some slowdown in Europe. We did well here in Australia during the GFC. partly because of our own stimulus and the circumstances we were in. But never forget that the Chinese spent 18 trillion Chinese yuan stimulating the Chinese economy to avert the GFC in China, and that flowed straight through to us. Thank you very much, Mr. President. China has ample buffers, fiscal and monetary, and internal momentum in our view to withstand what's happening in Europe, unless it gets really bad. Here in Australia, the spillover is mostly coming through the financial markets. There has been, as you know, threatened downgrades of Australian banks by one of our ratings agencies that's just catching up with the others. Yes, our banks are obviously exposed to international capital markets. They're desperately trying to hoover up whatever deposits they can find domestically. And so those of us who are retirees doing quite well out of our bank deposits and certificates of deposit, it's causing havoc with competitive conditions within the financial markets. The big banks are getting very big. And when all four of them turn up to the waterhole at once, the little ones find very little water left. And that makes life difficult when you're trying to deal with the banks. Just talk to Mr. Swan. But we have some natural protection. The scope for easing monetary and fiscal policy is there if we need it. That's another reason why the Reserve Bank didn't lower interest rates last week or the week before. Glenn Stevens is keeping his powder dry. Very shrewd. Chinese economy is growing. We've got India in the wings. And, of course, we have substantial business investment. Here's the so-called Brisbane line. Chris Richardson likes to use that term. Thing is, he grew up south of Brisbane line. I grew up north of the Brisbane line. You get a very different story. Well, what he's simply saying is on this side of the line, of course, is where all the business investment is occurring. Not many jobs being generated, mostly mining investment. But an enormous amount of business investment. And south of the line, lower employment. Most of the jobs are here, but a smaller share of the investment projects. Nevertheless, there is nothing there. There is no line. There is no ditch. So the money which gets spent finds its way back at some point. But it finds its way around in different forms. Two final charts. This one really just shows you the domestic forecast. We are agreeing with the IMF. There's a forecast for growth in GDP in Australia. I told you about the two halves of this calendar year. A little bit slower in the first half. Predicted to strengthen off the back of very strong business investment in the second half. And then returning to our roughly 3 to 3.5% on average, which is where we see the Aussie economy going. So long as the Australian economy grows like that, then we will see unemployment not rise much. This morning's dramatic headline that it was going up from 5.2 to 5.3. Please don't hear me be cynical about people losing their job. It's a very serious thing. But unemployment at 5.3% is nothing compared to where we could be. Will it get worse, I hear you cry. Our forecasts indicate not. Partly because there'll be adjustments in ours, which lie behind that, but partly because the economy, if it grows at 3.5%, it will grow fast enough to absorb labour. They will not be absorbed into the car industry, it has to be said, and not into financial services. The financial services industry is undergoing its own version of Macaubra adjustment. But thankfully, the car industry and the financial services industry are not all there is to the Australian economy. There is, as they say, much more. Thank you very much. Just grab that.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. I think that was heartening. I must say, whenever I hear the words Greece, Portugal, Spain, my heart begins to pound. But it's nice to have a bit of optimism. It's nice to have soundly based optimism, and I think I've certainly found it extremely interesting and enlightening. We've got 20 minutes of questions. Please indicate your name and any organisation with which you're affiliated. This gentleman here.
Thank you very much. Europe.
Your name, please.
Oh, my name is Edmund Lavata.
Thank you, Edmund.
The only person I represent is myself. Europe is not only the Eurozone, there's a lot of countries that are not in the Eurozone.
Correct.
Including Britain.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
I come from a different background, but we like to have control groups and non-control groups. Have you done any work to sort of compare like. You know,
life is like inside and outside the Eurozone.
Side versus the controlled side, which is about 10 countries
during
European Union that are not.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you, Edmund. Well, one answer is that even though it sounds like it would be a controlled experiment, of course it wouldn't be. There's a whole lot more happening outside the Eurozone that would influence whatever you see there. But the reality is that those countries outside the Eurozone that are still growing don't have the burdens that the Greeks and Italians have in respect of the strong currency. They can trade with their own currencies, such as they are. But, you know, that isn't to say... Obviously, there are other advantages associated with having a single currency. That's why we have a single currency. And we pay to keep the Tasmanians and the South Australians to the standard to which they've become accustomed in order to hold that together, because there are obvious benefits. So, no one has done that calculation in the way that you would describe it. At this stage, the main driver of the breaking up or the pressure that's come on the Eurozone is the result of those two things together. The value, the overvaluation or the wrong value, the inflexibility of the Euro mechanism, and secondly, of course, fiscal profligacy on the part of certain members of the Eurozone, which I might add includes the Germans and the French. They also violated the Maastricht Agreement. So, you know, it is a case of people in glass houses not throwing stones. But obviously it doesn't matter much in their case, or as much, because they're much more resilient economies. Thank you.
Yeah, thank
you. One of the biggest problems I see with the UK and the Eurozone is that the UK has a legal and a constitutional significant difference from the European zone.
Yeah.
And I foresaw 30 years ago that would be a major stumbling block for Britain, and Britain would not want to become inter pares as another state in the European Union for any great comfort. David Cameron's move starts to raise those specters again.
Well, you take me beyond my expertise. It's an excellent question, Will. I think the best I could say is to come back to the remark I made earlier on, that institutions matter a great deal. You're pointing to the, if I understand you correctly, the sort of English common law tradition, if you like, versus the Roman civil law, which drives, of course, Germany and France and others in Europe. That's just the beginning of differences in institutional history and framework. I think that certainly when Margaret Thatcher was so adamant that Britain would not go in, she had all of those things in mind. At the moment, the conversation is very much an economic conversation. But all you have to do is to see the British reacting to various court decisions that get made in Brussels, and you can see how incompatible, arguably, they are. So I wouldn't imagine that the British would go anywhere near it within my lifetime, and I don't think they've got any particular reason to. As to whether the Europeans should continue with this experiment, I mean, that's a bigger deal. They've got a whole lot invested in this, clearly. And I think the experience in our own case, not that the states were at each other's throats, but they were in the United States, the union in the United States, is something which, you know, one could easily argue that economic union in the United States helped to bind together the southern states and the northern states, and to subsidiarize bitternesses which you would know are still there in the United States, but they are papered over because of the way in which the US fiscal and monetary institutions operate. So I'm very much with J.M. Keynes and the establishment of the International Monetary Fund and the Bretton Woods institutions. Economics isn't everything, but economic trade and development and investment can make up for a multitude of sins. Not all of them, but certainly a multitude. And I hope that the Europeans can make this work for their sake.
I'm Zara Kipton from the Institute. Victoria, in the heart of manufacturing in this country for many years.
Yes.
You talked about the strong euro compared with Germany and Greece. At some stage, the strong dollar, it must be already affected Victoria.
It is.
You've been head of the Pay Commission. We've just seen Holden make a very generous offer to their to their unions. I feel extremely pessimistic about Victoria moving forward. If we don't have a motor industry, how can we compete? Is it right for governments to be propping up industry. I know this, you know, Judith Sloan's been writing about
sure.
this. She's a colleague of yours, was a colleague of yours.
She was.
What is your view in it?
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, I'm completely orthodox on that front, I have to say, which is governments working against comparative advantage in economies always ends in tears. It simply throws good money after bad, which isn't to say, as Judith and Gary Banks and others have pointed out, it's not to say that there shouldn't be adjustment assistance. But the adjustment assistance should be of the old John Button plan type, which is, here's the key, right? I've swallowed it, right? The machine is running, it is on its track. In 10 years' time, there will be no more assistance, and there's nothing you can do about it, so I suggest you start today. And off they go. So they're given their 10 years to adjust. So my view strongly is that throwing good money after bad is a very poor policy, and it actually prevents the adjustment that needs to take place. However, some sort of assistance clearly to assist people to move from one occupation to another is warranted. When, you know, the death of the manufacturing industry has been called in this country on many occasions. During the 1980s, people thought that manufacturing in Australia would disappear as a result of the removal of the tariffs. Manufacturing is still 14% of GDP. Still 14% of GDP. And the 1980s are now nearly 30 years ago. Right? During that time, the Australian economy has doubled in size. So that means the Australian manufacturing industry has doubled in size over the last 25... Excuse me? This was the manufacturing industry which was going to die. No. Well, how come it doubled in size? It doubled in size because our manufacturers are clever and faced with the same incentives the rest of us face. They get off the backsides and they do something about it. So I'm not going to write the manufacturing industry off. And Zara, I would also say that there's a great deal more to the Victorian economy than manufacturing, which I'm sure you know.
Well,
let me refer you then to a report, not the one we did, but there's a thing called the Victorian Competition and Efficiency Commission, the VCEC of late fame. And the VCEC wrote a report exactly on this issue on Victoria's comparative advantages and what we should be doing and how we could see our productivity improving. I'd commend you to read that, and then you will see there's a good deal more to Victoria than meets the eye. And the fact is that we've been growing amongst the fastest of the states, and one of the reasons we've been doing that, even though we have no mining industry and a manufacturing industry which is under stress, quite clear, we've been growing fastest because Victoria's population has been growing fastest. Otherwise, it's all about people. Oh, and indeed. But why do they come here? They come here because there's more to this place than the auto industry. Well, they might do too. I'm an optimist. Sorry.
Miriam Leskey,
Thank you, Miriam.
My question is, what would happen if Greece was to be let go?
To the Greeks or to the rest of Europe?
Well, in general, to the Greeks and to...
Okay. Okay. The reality, Miriam, and I forgive me if you're of Greek heritage, ma'am.
No.
Okay. I know some others are in the audience. Look, the Greek economy is not particularly large, right? And so, if the Greek economy were to secede from Europe, it would make no difference. That's the reality. Obviously, some banks, particularly Greek banks, would find themselves in difficulty for a time for the reasons I've indicated, and others would lose money on their lending to Greeks, and that would cause some problems here and there, but it would not be an issue. The reason the Greek issue has arisen is that it represents the thin edge of a rather large and awkward wedge. I.e., if the Greeks go, the markets are frightened, and now they take Italy, Portugal, Spain, and now you do have a problem. Okay? So that it's that slippery slope argument, which is the main argument. As far as the Greeks are concerned, well, as I say, they've got Hobson's choice. If they stay in, they have to find a way to beat the economy into the shape that's necessary. They have to get wages down. They have to stop paying pensions. They've cut the minimum wage by 20%. Huh? Unemployment has to rise. Prices have got to fall. As Keynes pointed out in the 1930s, that is a very, very painful way to adjust the economy. Will it get there? Yes, it will, in the long run. But, dot, dot, dot. And so the reason for economists supporting floating exchange rates, including here in Australia, famously in 1983, is because the adjustment happens so much more easily when the exchange rate does the work for you. Which is why, with our exchange rate running at $1.07, people, at least trained economists, are saying, no, you don't intervene, right? It is doing what it needs to do. Rather like your body temperature, right? Yeah, we, you know, if the temperature, surely, if your body temperature goes way up under the fever, yes, it could give you permanent brain damage, right? But within a certain margin, the fever is actually positive. It's the system dealing with the problem. And that's what the exchange rate is doing. The problem for the Greeks is the exchange rate mechanism has switched off. So letting the Greeks out would probably be better for them if it were just them. But it isn't.
John,
oh, our exchange rate? Well, as my economist colleagues, the one or two in the room would know, it's a very foolish thing for economists to do, predict the exchange rate. So, having said that, look, you know, fair value for the Australian dollar is still about 75 cents US. We all know that purchasing power parity theory can be out of whack for up to 30 or 40 years. So, that's telling you the exchange rate for the Australian dollar could stay way above 75 cents for 30 or 40 years.
It doesn't work well.
Pardon me?
It doesn't work well.
Well, no, it does, you see, because what the exchange rate is doing is actually providing the signals that are required to release the resource. I mean, it sounds all very clinical, and at some level it is. But as my colleagues have been pointing out in the newspaper, if you don't want wages to blow absolutely through the roof, and you're making this point, Zara, you have to release labour from those parts of the economy where it is less productive and release it for those parts of the economy where it's more productive. You've got to do that. If you jam the system up, then, I'm mixing my metaphors here, the steam will blow out of another seam and it'll blow out through wages. We are going through a very difficult transition. It is not the first time we did this. We're living through what is in many respects a repeat economically of what happened in the second half of the 19th century. And the second half of the 19th century, when it was not, well, it was mining, but it was importantly wool and wheat as well as mining, drove wages up and employed hardly anybody. And the rest of the economy was in small-scale manufacturing and they simply could not compete. People walked out of their offices. You know those stories. People left their government offices and walked onto the gold fields. It was a disaster. So what we did, we're the only country in the world that did this. When we federated, we handed to the federal government what we know as the arbitration power. And we gave the federal government the right to set wages. That was the economist's prescription. And from 1907, that's exactly what we did. We didn't use a mining tax last time. We fixed wages and we spread the largesse from the growing part of the economy to the weaker part of the economy by fixing wages and putting in place a tariff. We won't do that again because 70 years' worth of experience told us that it's a very expensive policy. It works, but it costs us our living standard. This time around, we've tried the mining tax, which was, with due respect to the parties involved, hopelessly, appallingly handled politically, even though it is a very sensible piece of economic policy. Whether we get something back like that, I don't know. But we have to find a mechanism to adjust these differing rates of growth, and the exchange rate is about the best one we've got. What the exchange rate does is modify the earnings of the miners by reducing the amount of Australian dollars they get for every US dollar, dollars worth of coal they sell, so it sort of puts the lid on the miners. And regrettably, it forces the services industries to release labour in their favour to try and keep that process going. How do the non-mining industries survive through this? They survive by increasing their productivity. That's the only way they can do it. Hence the focus on the Fair Work Act, folks, right? And hence the debate about whether the Fair Work Act is standing in the way of productivity improvements. That's a vital question for us.
One question here.
Fine.
Probably.
Yep.
Where do we go?
Okay. My question was kind of related.
Name?
Oh, sorry. My name is Chris. Chris Botha.
Yes. Thank you, Chris.
I'm representing myself. My question is kind of related to the one Zara asked earlier. Mm. It was also about. I can see almost this kind of comparison, whereas you can compare Australia to Europe in the sense that. the high Australian dollar, I'm assuming, is partly caused by the demand for our resources up in Greece.
Almost wholly, Chris.
So, in this sense, would you be able to say that the Australian dollar is undervalued in Western Australia and Queensland and overvalued in...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, indeed.
In a sense, so we've also got a problem with a currency union, in a sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely right, mate. But we manage that, we stabilise that with internal transfers. I think I made the point that the West Australians, for the first time, are finding themselves paying this tax, and they do not like it. Right? So through what's called fiscal equalisation. Right? We tax the West Australians, and we subsidise the South Australians and the Victorians. The Tasmanians. Right? And if this process continues, they'll find themselves subsidising New South Welshmen and Victorians as well.
But we've done that for years.
Well, we went the other way for years.
Sorry.
Jeffrey.
Reading the London Telegraph, which I do every day, and they had a marvellous cartoon. Mm-hmm. Two men standing by a printing press.
Mm-hmm.
And one says to the other, "What are you doing?"
Mm-hmm.
He says, "I'm printing euros. If I'm caught, I'm going to plead insanity."
He should plead patriotism.
Now, will the Germans continue paying Europe's bills unless they have fiscal union, firstly?
Yeah.
Secondly, if they do have fiscal union, who and how will they
police
it? They're supposed to have legally enforceable contracts with the Maastricht Treaty.
They did, exactly. Let's take the second one first. I have no idea, which is why it makes fiscal union and the various prospects they put up lacking in credibility, shall we say, right? Because everybody asks your question, Geoffrey. You couldn't make the Maastricht Treaty work, right? There is no political union. How can you do this? A brief aside, we disciplined the New South Wales government, as you're aware, under Jack Lang when we faced exactly this problem in the 30s. And the New South Wales government essentially said, hang it, right? We will continue to spend and the Commonwealth will pick up our debt. And the Commonwealth said, not on your life. And the New South Wales government backed away, right? Because of a fiscal union. The answer to the first question, of course, is up to the Germans. As I've tried to point out to you, they have Hobson's choice as well. They've got to think about weighing up the impact of, for example, letting the Greeks default, letting the euro unwind, the resulting impact that would have firstly on the currency and then on economic activity in Europe, all of which would arguably toss the German economy into recession or at the very least eliminate the experience they've just had, versus writing a cheque, right? Versus writing a cheque when they're doing quite nicely. Now, I don't expect the Germans to write a cheque without conditions, and that's what they're trying to impose. But the other side knows that the Germans are doing quite nicely out of this, and hence you have the classic tension which we see played out before our screens. The others think exactly the same thing, that the Germans will eventually pay, indeed they must pay, because they're benefiting from this system, and they won't back out because the alternative for them is recession, the alternative for... Angela Merkel is being tossed out of government.
Can I just add something? My daughter returned from a year in Germany, studying at Free University of Berlin. I said, do they want the Deutschmark back? I said, no, they want the euro.
Now you know why.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to cut the questions off, but we do try to finish pretty much on time. Ian, thank you very much for an extremely elusive, stellar performance. These are very, very complex issues. These are very, very complex issues, and to have those issues explained in such lucid terms and such comprehensible terms was a great achievement. Even I understood some of it. on behalf of you all, I'd like to thank Ian very much, and I hope that this gift will find a good home.
Before it's drunk, that's for sure.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Let me just make a few comments about our ongoing program. Next week, we will not have a speaker.
But we will have on Thursday, same time, we will have a new members evening, a new members and prospective members networking evening. So you don't have to be a new member, you don't have to be a prospective member, but we want you if you are. But if you're an existing member, come along and make our new members and our prospective members feel welcome and talk to them about what you think of the Institute, what you think the Institute could do for them and they can do for us. On Thursday, the 1st of March, we have Mr. M.J. Akbar, who is the editorial director of India Today, who will be talking about relations with Australia and the region and how to jazz them up. On the 8th of March, Thursday the 8th of March, a session on microfinance, the answer to poverty eradication and women's empowerment, with the speaker being on International Women's Day, I might point out, the speaker being Ms. Casey Ranjani, the India Director of Opportunity International Australia. Then you can go back and test your what you've learnt today, because we've got a session on From Crisis to Salvation, Can Mario Monti Save Italy? And that's on Thursday the 15th of March, Thursday the 22nd of March, another issue, I think it is immensely preoccupying, on the edge of a nuclear crisis. And the speaker is Dr. Emanuele Ottolenghi, the Foundation for Defence of Democracies in Washington. And on the 29th of March, after Obama, back to the Joint Defence Facilities with Professor Richard Tanter. So it's a full program, and I think it's a pretty good program. And we look forward to seeing you all at almost all, if not all, of those events. Thank you very much.
Deserving of support.
Come along to the session.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I just can't believe it happened. 10 years ago,
I was a minister of education. Why? Well, as I say, they hoped that 2 out of 3 would work.
People like me thought it would.
Well, you're right. Indicators are.